This is Macro Voices with hedge fund manager Eric Townsend, the free weekly financial podcast targeting professional finance, high net worth individuals, family offices, and other sophisticated investors. Macro Voices is all about the brightest minds in the world of finance and macroeconomics telling it like it is, bullish or bearish, no holds barred. Now, here are your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Macro Voices episode 316 was recorded on March 24th, 2022. I'm Eric Townsend. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Masterworks, the billion-dollar alternative investment platform that lets you invest in art by legends like Warhol and Picasso for a fraction of the cost. Tresis Chief Economist Daniel Lacaille returns as this week's feature interview guest. We'll discuss everything from inflation to bond yields to the dollar's role as reserve currency. Then be sure to stay tuned for our post-game segment when Patrick's chart deck is titled, What's Next for the Markets?
And I'm Patrick Serezna. Eric, let's jump to that S&P 500. Really looks like in the post-Fed period, a short-term stock market low is in. But what's next here? I mean, we're already at the 4,500 level. Was this just a short-term bounce, or do you think this has legs and we are heading right back to the previous highs?
I don't think we're headed back to the previous highs, but I will also acknowledge I really don't have strong conviction here. As I've been saying for the last few weeks, I don't understand why the market has held up as well as it has. So we had Charlie McElligott tell us in a tightening cycle like this, we should expect the market to sell off and don't expect to see a bottom until May or so. So I'm not sure why it's been as strong as it's been, and I'm definitely suspicious of this rally.
All right. Well, let's move on to the dollar index because we continue to see it's relatively stable and certainly hasn't started any major sell cycle. Obviously, certain currencies like the yen are really weak. The U.S. dollar is strong against those currencies. We can talk about in the post game. But right now, dollar index more or less just approaching 99. Is there more upside?
I think there is more upside. I think the war cycle is very compatible with dollar strength, so I expect it to continue. Now, as I've said before, my longer-term prediction is eventually I think the U.S. dollar is going to lose its reserve currency status, but we're nowhere close to the point of that happening yet. I think that just in the last week, I've seen a few comments that have come out that are suggesting to me that the global frustration with the U.S. dollar, and particularly the concern that other governments have about the U.S. government's willingness without any due process of law to just cancel a sovereign nation's foreign exchange reserves, that's leading to significant concern, I think. But it doesn't translate in the immediate sense to a change in the dollar index. It translates to a change in the priorities of other nations, which will eventually be reflected in the tape in years to come.
All right. Well, let's move on to crude oil. We printed almost 116 on that May contract, and we're right now down $2.50, down to about 112, but quite the bounce off the mid-90s where we were just a week ago. Does this still have legs, or is this just a bounce off of a very oversold market?
Well, I think it does still have legs, but I've got to admit the trading got harder here. You know, when we were at $62, it was a really easy call to say we're going higher, going above 100 this year. Well, okay, we're already above 100. So I think the reason that we're likely to go considerably higher still is I don't think that this Russia versus the West tension is over yet. And I think that there's plenty of potential to get well north of $150. Now, if you look at just a retest, it's been a long time now since 2008. It's time for a retest of the all-time high at $147. That's $147 in nominal terms. In inflation-adjusted terms, that would be about $220 just to retest the previous all-time high. So there's lots of room for this market to go higher, but what will take it higher is further escalation of tension with Russia. If we get a big de-escalation with Russia, then I think oil corrects back lower. So we're getting into a situation now where you really can't be in the oil market unless you have a geopolitical view. And I think that's the reason that we've seen a pretty significant decrease in open interest.
Eric, how did the inventory numbers come in?
Crude oil drawing down 2.5 million barrels. That obviously helped to fan the flames and push the price higher during trading yesterday. Cushing, Oklahoma, building a very much needed 1.2 million barrels. That's two build weeks in a row for Cushing. Gasoline drawing down 2.9 million barrels. Distillates drawing down 2.1 million barrels with U.S. production flat at 11.6 million barrels.
All right, well, let's move on to gold, because gold obviously had the other week a pretty sharp pullback from what was a pretty strong bull breakout. And it's most of the week it consolidated, but today a little bit of an uptick. We're up at 1964 at the time of recording. Do you think this has room to go now?
Yeah, we've certainly moved above the short-term moving averages with today's move. It's definitely refreshing. In the grand scheme of things, though, I think gold has definitely underperformed expectations. If you look at copper or various other inflation hedges, gold has performed about the worst of the bunch.
Eric, let's wrap up by touching on that 10-year Treasury yield. The last 2 weeks, we saw an extraordinary move of 50 basis points in a very short window. But it's really, in my mind, the slope of the rise that's been really interesting. I mean, we're a stone throw away from a 2.5 yield. What's your take on this bond market?
Well, you said it, Patrick. It's getting interesting, and it's getting interesting fast. I was happy to admit a few weeks ago that I wasn't sure which way this was going to go, but I was really sure it was time to watch it closely. Well, if you've been watching it closely, it's really clear which way it's going now. Rates are backing up. So the question is, how far can they go? I think it is inflation-driven. My guess is they can go farther than most people expect, but we'll see what happens.
Well, this week's feature interview guest is Tress's chief economist and fund manager, Daniel Lecaille. Eric, why did we get Daniel on the show this week?
Well, Patrick, Daniel's one of our favorite people, but particularly he's in Europe and he has a European perspective. So with everything going on with central banks around the world, I wanted to get that European macro perspective into the fray.
Well, Eric's interview with Daniel is coming up as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor.
Abex Technologies invites you to Smarter Markets' new podcast series, Demystifying Carbon Markets. Corporate climate pledges went mainstream in 2021. Moving into 2022, these companies are increasingly focused on developing and implementing plans to turn their climate pledges into climate action and understanding how carbon markets can help them turn their good intentions into meaningful change. For many, however, carbon markets remain unfamiliar, creating apprehension over potential risks. They have many questions. What are carbon markets? What types of projects help reduce carbon emissions? How do I judge the quality of these projects? Will the carbon markets be large enough to meet net zero goals? In this series, Smarter Markets teams up with Base Carbon Corporation to bring you the architects and practitioners of the carbon markets, seeking answers to all of these questions from people who know the markets best. Episodes are available weekly on Saturdays beginning February 5th.
And now, with this week's special guest, here's hedge fund manager Eric Townsend.
Joining me now is Daniel Lecaille, fund manager and chief economist for Tressis. Daniel, it's great to have you back on the show. What to talk about? Holy cow. Well, let's see. We have the beginning of a tightening cycle, and oh, by the way, World War III broke out. What do we make of this?
Thanks very much for having me to start with. It's a great pleasure to be here again. I think that where we are right now is in a very difficult situation. I wouldn't like to be in the place of Mr. Powell these days. Because on the one hand, central banks need to find a way to put a brake on inflationary pressures, and they need to give a clear signal to markets about their willingness to do so, while at the same time, extremely accommodative, because the deficit spending of governments remains elevated. The U.S. government is likely to enter into a third year of record deficit spending, and that means a risk of seeing bond yields going through the roof if normalization actually does happen. No? So I'm pretty skeptical about this path of seven hikes that has been repeated over and over, fundamentally because the reality that we have seen in estimates all over the world from independent analysts is one of a worrying trend, which is on the one hand, a reduction in growth estimates with an increase in inflation estimates. And what's more concerning to me about what I see from consensus is that those inflation estimates come down very, very rapidly in the second half of 2022 to reach a level that seems acceptable for those analysts. And if one makes an analysis of what would be required for that abrupt reduction in inflation to happen, it would essentially need to come from a massive destruction of demand, which obviously means that the estimates of GDP are either wrong or the estimates of inflation are wrong. And in that situation, the Fed, European Central Bank, even more so, are caught between a rock and a hard place. They need to, on the one hand, give a clear signal of their willingness to curb inflation. And on the one hand, they need to continue to be extremely accommodative in a market and in a sovereign bond environment in which the issuers and market participants remain extremely complacent.
Let's talk about what this means for both growth and inflation rates in various different economies around the world, because something I'm noticing is different analysts are coming to radically different views. Some are saying, look, the Fed is setting up what almost certainly has to be a recession that has to mean that major destruction of demand that you're talking about. We're headed into deep recession. Demand is going down. You know, forget about the inflation. It's going to be forgotten before you know it. Other people are saying, no, you don't understand. This inflation is out of the bag, can't be stopped now. It's gonna be difficult to stop it. Which is it, or what should we be worried about as we look ahead for the next 6 to 12 months?
Yes, I think that the difference with, for example, 2008 and other periods in recent history is that inflationary pressures have been contained by an abrupt destruction of demand, hence a recession. That is not so clear this time. You can actually have a recession because of the rise in core inflation, because of the increase in the price of non-replicable goods and services, despite the change of the economy. You can have an environment, there are many economies in which the increase in prices has absolutely nothing to do with demand growth. There are numerous economies, and in Europe, for example, we have seen that prior to the euro. So I've read a couple of articles out there saying maybe we're thinking too much about the 70s and thinking too much about 2008 and not thinking enough about the 40s, in which protectionist measures, in which all of these ideas that have suddenly reappeared in the minds of politicians about autarky and trying to limit the exports or the imports from one country or another has come back. And there is inflationary pressures because of supply challenges and because of the lack of availability of some of products that we have grown accustomed to see widely available. And there is a recession coming also from that factor, which is at the same time you get real wages coming down and you get an environment in which consumers feel the pinch of a rising core inflation despite a recessionary environment. So my point is that it's more likely that we see a stagflation environment in the next year, a year and a half, and that with it, it's a very complicated environment both for governments and for central banks, because obviously governments and central banks seem to be reasonably equipped to take measures to curb inflationary or deflationary problems, but hardly with Keynesian tools, they're going to be able to manage an environment of stagflation. So that is, to me, the biggest problem. The risk of stagflation is rising, and we actually could find ourselves in a situation in which either the Ukraine war ends and or the conflict remains in a prolonged sort of way, as we have seen so many other conflicts, and inflationary pressures and supply challenges remain in the economy without that sort of injection of higher demand.
Daniel, I'd like to clarify what you just said about stagflation. You're in Europe. Are we talking about the Eurozone is where you foresee this stagflation? Do you mean everywhere? And I guess let's just broaden it. Let's go through the different geographies around the world and talk about growth and inflation, starting with the Eurozone. What do you see in the Eurozone? Then we'll move on to U.S., Russia, China, etc.
In our estimates, the risk of stagflation in the Eurozone is the highest. It's about 85%. Right now, followed by Latin American economies, which already had a problem of inflation despite the period of what we called in the US or the Eurozone no inflation. No? So those two economies are the ones where the risk of stagflation is the highest, almost, as I said, 80-85%. In the case of the United States, I think it's different. And I think it's different for one reason. Core CPI is rising rapidly, but the U.S. economy is better equipped to pass through the Ukraine crisis in a much more robust way. Let's start with why. No, the first, obviously, the United States economy doesn't have almost any exposure to Russia. No? The second one is that it's an economy that exports very little. In the case of the United States, exports relative to GDP are almost less than half what they are in the Eurozone. And the third is that obviously the inflationary pressures coming from energy have two ways. On the one hand, obviously, they impact consumers, but at the same time, the energy industry in the United States is relatively stronger. So that is the reason why I believe the risk of stagflation in the United States is slightly lower than in the Eurozone or in Latin America. In China, we have a problem with the data because it's extremely hard to believe that the inflation, that CPI, as published by the Chinese government, is as low as it is. And the other problem that we have with the data and that we have discussed in other occasions is the reliability of the GDP figure, also coming from the deflator of CPI that they use to reach that real GDP figure. So I'm not entirely sure about what is the possibility of let's say, official stagflation in China. However, the risk of a very abrupt slowdown of the Chinese economy is enormous because of the burst of the real estate bubble, and inflation, we believe, is probably twice, if not 2.5 times higher than the official one.
Daniel, I want to focus a little bit more on energy and what you've said about that, because I'm hearing one view that seems to be pretty common out there, which is people are saying, look, you've got this big inflation risk, but don't worry about that relative to energy, because what's going to happen is we're going to have a recession thanks to the Fed's hiking policy, and that's going to take care of any tension that might exist with respect to energy prices. I think that's very naive thinking. I think it's the exact opposite. I think it's much more like, wait a minute, what if the cause of the recession is runaway high energy prices? And that's the issue that we have to contend with. What do you think here? Do we need to be worried about energy being the center of an inflation problem, or is the inflation really independent of energy?
I completely agree with you. I think that people are extremely naive about this idea that is repeated now for more than a year, that it's going to come down next month. And it comes a time in which you start to, you really start to really be a little bit more intellectually honest. And those people should start to see that what is happening in the energy space has structural and at the same time current problems. The structural problem is massive underinvestment. And we know that for many years, because of capital allocation preferences into other sectors, etc., the energy complex and the mining complex has been sort of neglected to a certain extent. And that has led to an environment in which, even with a significant reduction in demand estimates coming from, for example, OPEC, the reality is that prices continue to increase and that inventories continue to draw. So I think that we need to be more concerned about energy prices and less concerned about rate hikes. We hear many times in financial analysis, etc., and in media that it's too many rate hikes what is going to generate a recession. Well, no, because this time, to start with, even if we believed, which I don't, the path of rate hikes that has been laid at the dot plot by the Federal Reserve, it will continue to be real negative rate territory. So that, to start with, is something that doesn't bother me, and financial conditions remain extremely loose. So those two don't worry me as the drivers of recession. What worries me about a driver of recession is that energy prices remain extremely elevated and start to feed through all of the other goods and services that we utilize. And it becomes one of the driving factors of a recession, and that which comes back to the point of the 1940s or the crisis of 2008.
Dale, let's talk a little bit more about what this situation means for the Chinese economy. Where is China going to be through this crisis with Ukraine, and what are the consequences for the U.S. relationship with China going to be?
It's very, very difficult to predict, because China right now is in a very tough position, because on the one hand, Russia is a key partner of China in numerous economies and in a general perception about the strategy and their view of global politics. And on the other hand, China needs to continue to export massively to the rest of the world in order to at least try to offset the brutal impact on the economy of the burst of the real estate bubble. And having such an enormous real estate bubble as China has, which is directly and indirectly weighs about 25% of the GDP of the country, its position in terms of where they stand relative to Russia and Ukraine leaves them in a very weak position as well in terms of their export capacity and their attraction of investment. So for China, the first thing that I would say is that it's very difficult for an economy to grow at the pace that the Communist Party has laid out when, one, they have such a massive real estate bubble that is bursting in front of our eyes. Second, when at the same time they're trying to impose massive restrictions and corporate governance intervention on key sectors that would, in some capacity, be the drivers of future growth. So what that tells us is that the Chinese economy is closing, not opening. And at the same time, it is becoming more risky for foreign investors to put money in China in the real economy because of intervention in different sectors, according to the political view of the moment. The position with Russia is very difficult as well, because China is very exposed both to Russia and to Ukraine. This is the biggest foreign investor in Ukraine and also the biggest foreign investor in Russia. So the impact on its financial sector of the sanctions imposed on Russia are relevant. difficult to assess right now because obviously China has capital controls, and at the same time, it has a less than transparent way of dealing with non-performing loans, etc., compared to, let's say, Europe or the US. So my concern in China is that the situation is very delicate, and very delicate in a moment in which internal demand is not the driver of GDP growth. I think obviously the Chinese economy is phenomenal, and it's a very, very strong economy, but it has a significant weakness, which is its dependence on the US dollar. It has a currency, the yuan, that is used in less than 3% of global transactions, whilst the US dollar is used in 41%. And that yuan, on top of it, has capital controls and a fixed rate that obviously many participants might prefer to believe that is realistic or not, but we don't know because it's not free floating. So China needs to continue to export massively. The exports to the Eurozone are coming down very, very rapidly because of the weakness of the Eurozone and the second derivative impact of the Ukraine war on the Eurozone. We saw, for example, recently, the data of trade surplus in the Eurozone, which has been a major driver of its growth, and it's gone from a trade surplus to a trade deficit. This is negative for the euro. It is negative for these economies that need the external market to grow because obviously, either demographically or because of other factors, Eurozone countries are not high growth economies. And China is there sort of in the middle between a Russia that is likely to lose between 11 to 15% of its GDP in 2022 with massive inflation. Inflation estimates for Russia move around 20, 25%. And obviously a market that was absolutely critical for China, Russia, Ukraine, Europe, in order to reach its 5.5-6% level of GDP growth, has been reduced dramatically. It's been cut massively because those levels of consumption that were expected to happen in 2022 are not going to happen. So ultimately, the problem in China is, how do they deal with the real estate bubble and what is going on with the real estate sector? It is not very transparent, so it's not easy to monitor the same way that we would monitor the US or the European real estate bubble. Second, how they offset the real estate weight in the economy with other sectors, not very easy to do. Even less so, third, because of massive intervention in the key sectors that could actually attract foreign investment and generate higher growth. And finally, its external position is seeing that their highest added value exports are going to be suffering because of the Eurozone slowdown and the Russia collapse, while their position relative to the Belt and Road Initiative, which has been a financial nightmare, is worse as Latin American and some African countries find themselves in a twin deficit situation.
Daniel, let's go back to central bank policy. We talked about the hiking cycle that's just begun. Now, Goldman Sachs, I think, had a note out saying the next two hikes would be 50 basis points each back-to-back at the next two meetings. It sounds like your view is much more on the other end of the spectrum towards less hikes. Tell us why. What is it that you see differently from the way Goldman sees this?
In my opinion, I found the Goldman Sachs note very interesting because I find it very difficult to bet on one thing and the opposite at the same time. The massive slash of GDP estimates that Goldman Sachs has implemented makes it very difficult for the Fed to put in action such aggressive rate hikes. And we saw it with the last one. it was going to be 50, even 75 basis points. It ended up being 25. The second thing about that note is that Goldman Sachs basically sees that the reason why inflation is running fast in the United States economy is a function of high growth, high demand growth, and strong wage growth. But I would disagree with that. Is that the reality? Is that real wage growth is very subdued, if not negative? The reality is that real consumption is very subdued as well and has been worse, and that the growth of the U.S. economy has been fundamentally led by a massive increase in, for example, in the last GDP figure of inventories. No? So I think that the likelihood of that we see a Federal Reserve that does not a U-turn like in 2018, but that starts to give the message, as they did in previous years, that the impact on the global economy of the Ukraine war is more severe than what we expected. Therefore, because of geopolitical concerns, we are going to be slower in the rate hike path, in my opinion, is very likely, because they've done it in the past. Janet Yellen, even Jerome Powell, both decided to step down on the path of rate hikes or of normalization that they announced, because not just of slowdown or reductions in the estimates for the domestic economy, but because of concerns about the global economy. I find it very, very difficult to believe that the two things, a massive worsening of global GDP growth to virtually stagflation, even recession, numerous economies like the one that Goldman Sachs is estimating would happen, and at the same time see the Federal Reserve take the levels of aggressive action that they estimate. Also, for a very simple reason, is that the Federal Reserve can cling on to the message that the vast majority of inflationary pressures are coming from energy, even though I disagree, because inflationary pressures existed before, because the monetary factor is enormous. Countries in Asia that have a lot more exposure to imported energy have half of the inflation that the United States or the Eurozone have. So I think that the Federal Reserve will have to decide between being very aggressive or follow the path of rate hikes that they have indicated, or be more accommodative because the situation in the global economy is significantly weaker than they anticipated. My opinion, they're likely to fall on the side of the latter.
Now, that all makes sense to me, but I want to challenge one specific aspect of it, because what you're saying, as I understand it, is as the economy is weakening and not performing quite as well as they expect, they're going to have to say, okay, look, we're going to slow down the tapering process a little bit. What if we have a situation where, just as you say, the economy is really doing poorly, but inflation is also running away, perhaps driven by energy prices? So you've got that situation where, as you're anticipating, the Fed wants to slow down the hiking process because it seems like things haven't been going so well in the economy. But at the same time, the biggest problem in the economy is runaway energy prices, and you do have to do something to combat that. Could we get into a situation where they are in such a stagflation that they have to continue hiking even though they don't really want to?
The problem in this cycle is, in my opinion, the following. Rate hikes themselves are not going to make inventories go up. Rate hikes are not going to make the energy complex reduce prices. And why? Fundamentally, because it is the inflationary pressures that we're seeing don't come from run-amok demand growth. It is not you or I or anybody that's listening to us right now that is taking more credit and being more aggressive and buying three homes with very low rates, etc. It is governments spending massively on infrastructure or sending checks to families and to businesses, rescuing, bailing out sectors, etc., etc. Therefore, for a central bank, that situation is very, very difficult to contain. So the reason why I believe that they will not go down 50 basis points in the next meeting, 50 basis points in the other, it's like that, is because they haven't done it already. If they haven't done it with an economy in which the wage growth that they look at is good, the GDP growth that they look at is good, because they look at wage growth in nominal terms, not in real terms. The GDP growth that they have seen is good. And the job market that they see is robust, and they haven't done it, and they haven't gone down the 50 basis points route, then I find it very difficult to believe that they will do it in September when the situation is not as strong in either of those 3 points. In my view, right now, the Federal Reserve is confident because although we have seen some volatility in markets, credit conditions remain strong. Equity markets are correcting but not collapsing. There is nothing that sort of rocks the boat for them in the financial world. But obviously, we haven't yet started to see non-performing loans going through the roof because of the Russian situation and because of the slowdown in the economy. We have not yet seen a significant slowdown in the job market because there's still this concept of the great retirement and all these things. So what I basically look at is the way that the Federal Reserve takes decisions about the economy is by looking at a picture that is static, which is what has happened now. And their estimates historically have been very poor about inflation and also significantly poorer than other independent analysis in terms of growth. So if they start to adjust those, if I was in their position, I would be as prudent as I have shown to be in the last rate hike that we saw.
Daniel, I've been looking at the energy situation, which I think is absolutely essential to all of this. And I've been looking at it primarily from a U.S.-centric viewpoint, just because it's my background and area of knowledge. You're in Europe and have a lot of perspective on the European situation. Give us an overview of what's going on in terms of energy in Europe and the various measures that are being contemplated in terms of how we might react to the whole situation with Ukraine and so forth.
It's very important to look at the past. Energy prices for consumers in the European Union and the Eurozone have been rising all the time, even in periods in which natural gas prices were weak, in which the oil price was weak. So the big difference between the United States and the European Union in terms of energy for consumers is taxes. I sometimes envy my friends in America when they talk about $4 a gallon, because we are paying the equivalent of three times that in many places. No? So to start, we need to understand that the pricing structure in energy in Europe is full of taxes, massive, about 50% of the price of gasoline comes from taxes, higher than 50 actually, same with electricity. And there's something completely different from the United States, which that there is a carbon tax, the CO2 price, that elevates prices even in periods in which gas, coal, or oil prices are moderately weak. So problem of the European Union that generates less competitiveness and less growth that existed prior to COVID-19 and prior to the Ukraine crisis. What has happened now? What has happened now is that what was already in 2018 a very significant problem of lack of competitiveness and demand destruction has proven to be an even worse nightmare when commodities have started to rise. And what we're seeing from the European Union is extremely concerning, is that the European Commission is starting to think about the worst economic ideas that can be implemented, which is intervention of prices, intervention of companies, talking about the possibility of even capping prices or subsidizing part of the structure in order to try to mitigate the impact of the energy crisis. But the but what we're seeing, for example, all over the European Union is that the agricultural sector is drowning in the cost of energy, that the everything that has to do with industry is starting to shut down because of this problem. And instead of the European Commission trying to find more diversification of supply, better access to, for example, ample resources of natural gas coming from the United States, etc., of using all technologies in order to mitigate the energy crisis, what it is doing is shooting itself in the foot by implementing interventionist measures, which are not going to help reduce the dependency on Russian gas. Europe imports about 150 BCM of gas from Russia. It's very, very difficult to offset the gas coming from Russia with gas coming from natural gas coming from other sources because of lack of interconnection with pipelines and also because of price. So my worry is that yet again, like in 2008, the European Union, instead of deciding to go through a period in which what they can do is to increase diversification of supply, improvement of the different sources, and use all technologies to mitigate the impact on consumers, what it is aiming to do is to solve a problem of interventionism with even more interventionism. We must remember that electricity prices for households in the European Union are about twice as high than those of for the average household in the United States, and also pretty similar with natural gas prices for households. And that inflationary pressure plus interventionism means lower investment, lower job growth, and weaker companies in the future, which has not helped the European Union in the past. We have seen some of the large corporations of the European Union dissolve from being 60, 80, 90 billion companies to almost mid-cap size for US standards. And what we need to do is to pay a lot of attention, because I am truly concerned about this almost optimistic and idealistic view that what the European Union needs to do, or the United States needs to do, is to basically revamp the old and failed ideas of intervention of prices, intervention of sectors, virtual backdoor nationalization of companies, and the implementation of the measures that basically led European countries in their own, prior to the Eurozone being created, to be significantly behind their potential.
Daniel, an issue that's gotten a lot of attention has been the effective confiscation of Russia's foreign exchange reserves by the U.S. government. And specifically, what a number of people have raised is the question of if the U.S. government is going to essentially assert the authority to cancel the existence of a sovereign nation's, regardless of what they may have done to deserve it, but if the U.S. government is going to take punitive action on a country like Russia and effectively take away its foreign exchange reserves, can the U.S. government still be trusted as the issuer of the global reserve currency? A lot of people have said other nations around the world are going to look more skeptically at the dollar because of the aggressive action that was taken against Russia. What do you make of this? Do you agree? Is this an area of concern?
I don't agree. And the reason why is because there's no alternative. Let's start with the premise. It is not the United States that has implemented this. It is the United States, the European Union, the UK, Japan. So who's the alternative? Because it's easy to think that that the sanctions against Russia have been implemented by the United States and that the US dollar is the one that is exerting this sort of monopoly of the financial system globally. No. The Russian Central Bank has been sanctioned and not limited, but it's unavailable for them to get access to their reserves in euro, which are the biggest ones. The biggest percentage of reserves of the Russian Central Bank is the euro, 36%, followed by the US dollar, about 20%, followed by gold. But let's all remember, because a lot of people, when they talk about gold reserves in a central bank, believe it's in a vault, in a basement. Those are mainly swaps, and it doesn't have access to its pounds or its yen. So the issue here is not one of the U.S. dollar versus Russia, and what others may think about the U.S. dollar is what you think about the yen, the pound, the euro, the dollar. Is what you think about fiat currency in general, is that what we have shown with this crisis is that fiat currency in itself doesn't have any type of support in a global environment in which reserves are created by financial promissory notes, including the gold reserves. So for me, the issue is the following. First, there's no alternative. Which alternative do you have to the US dollar? There is no alternative. The yuan is, as I said before, is a currency with capital controls and with a fixed exchange rate from the central bank. The yuan is only used in 2.7% of transactions globally, which means that not even the multinationals in China use the yuan for their own transactions. And the euro is, with the US dollar, imposing these sanctions. So other countries may think, oh, I don't want to have reserves in US dollars. What can I have reserves in? Well, think about this. Are you going to have reserves in a currency, the yuan, that has capital controls and a fixed exchange rate? Obviously not. And not just obviously because of what is logical about those two problems, but because the likelihood that in the case of a political or geopolitical situation, the Chinese government would do exactly the same, but worse than the United States and the European Union and Japan and the UK. And why? Because rule of law, security, investor security, and the legal system is not as transparent and is not as robust, is even worse. So the problem I find is not about the US dollar versus the yuan, which, you don't substitute a bad fiat currency, the US dollar, but one that has high flexibility, high legal security, high investor security, and a tremendous level of liquidity with one that has all of the negatives of the US dollar. The yuan is also massively printed. The gold reserves of China are less than 0.3% of M2, the money supply of the country. So you don't find an alternative of a fiat currency that is widely available, free and open and transparent, with one that has all the negatives but is not transparent and it's not free. So maybe what this ends up doing is that other central banks might start to think about physical gold. It might be that other central banks might start to think about cryptocurrencies. But it's still so far-fetched because, there, let's be fairly honest, there is no central bank in the world that can go today and purchase the amount of physical gold reserves that they need in order to offset the reserves that they have in dollars or in euro or in yen or in pound. And more importantly, even if they did, that does not mean that their fiat currency is going to be safe or stable in an environment of these severe financial sanctions as the ones that we have seen. Because I come back to the point, we all remember the messages, no, of the ruble being the most gold-backed currency in the world, which is true. But look where the ruble was, not just after the sanctions, but prior to the sanctions.
Well, Daniel, I can't thank you enough for a terrific interview. Before I let you go, please tell our listeners a little bit about what you do at Tresis and for our institutional investors who are able to invest in hedge funds, how they can contact you.
I'm the chief economist at Tresis. In Tresis, we have a number of products that go from hedge funds to different long-only products and in fixed income, etc. It's mostly high net worth individual money. And the best way to find me is quite difficult not to find me. You can find me on Twitter. My Twitter account is at @dlacalle_IA. My website is dlacalle.com/en in English. You can find me on, obviously, in different books. And you have available my latest book, which is Freedom or Equality. The previous one talks about many of these things that we talked about in the interview, Escape from the Central Bank Trap, and prior to that, Life in the Financial Markets, all available in any retailer.
Patrick Serezna and I will be back as Macro Voices continues right after this message from our sponsor. I've got a mind-blowing stat for you. The richest 1% own 43% of global wealth, and they're only getting richer. How are they doing it? By building smart, well-diversified portfolios and investing in blue-chip art. With little correlation to equities, art prices have outpaced the S&P 500 from 1995 through 2021, which means when the market goes down, a well-diversified art portfolio might not. It's no wonder that ultra-wealthy collectors invest 10 to 30% of their overall portfolios in blue-chip art. Now you can, too, with Masterworks. Masterworks is the billion-dollar alternative investing platform that allows you to add paintings from iconic artists like Banksy, Picasso, and Basquiat to your portfolio at an affordable entry point. Masterworks is giving my listeners priority access to their newest offerings. Start building an intelligent portfolio today at masterworks.art/macrovoices. That's masterworks.art/macrovoices. See important disclaimers at masterworks.io/disclaimer.
Now, back to your hosts, Eric Townsend and Patrick Serezna.
Eric, it was great to have Daniel on the show. You know, it was really interesting getting that Europe perspective. It is a really interesting situation when looking at things in the perspective of Europe, right? Gasoline prices are way more expensive in Europe, and their supply chains are much less secure. And it'll be really interesting to see whether those kind of stagflationary scenarios really do emerge there.
Well, it's pretty clear to me, Patrick, that inflation has taken hold. Let's move on to our post-game chart deck. Listeners, you find the download link in your Research Roundup email. If you don't have a Research Roundup email, just go to our homepage, macrovoices.com. Look for the red button that says Looking for the Downloads. Patrick, the chart deck is titled What's Next for the Markets? Starting on page 2, we've got the S&P 500 chart. What's next for the S&P? If we look at this as a downsloping channel, it looks like we're kind of at the top of the channel about to start trading back down. I guess the other way to look at it is maybe this is a breakout that's going to take us back up to new all-time highs.
The way I perceive this is that we were in a market correction that lasted several months that was at that 15 to 20% style variety that was brought us to a pretty oversold state. And there was bad news after bad news being thrown at the market, and it failed to break down. So we had a situation where the market had some pent-up energy the other way, and we got ourselves a good little short squeeze that has now slingshotted this market above its moving averages. But I think that we're now in a period where the sell cycle's been neutralized, but that doesn't make it bullish. My view here is that while we're very likely to stay above the 4,400 level, even if it temporarily for a day or two drops below there, but we should see the market stabilize here and maybe even over the next week or two work its way higher toward 4,600. But I'm not so sure that we're going for a double top retest of the high. And so at this stage, I would actually approach this market from a very neutral perspective. I don't see a huge benefit on the upside, nor do I see an easy short layup here for a downside trade. So I'm expecting a little bit of a grind here for the next few weeks going into April.
So no strong trade conviction there. Let's move on to the Euro US dollar cross on page 3.
Oh, this is where I think I'd have a little more conviction because there's been a lot of reasons why the U.S. dollar should have given back some of the gains, and we should have seen bigger bounces, even to 112 or more on the euro, and we just haven't seen it at all. And with the current trend in the euro and the way it's rolling, it really does feel like the downside window is still wide open. When you go back and see the 2017 lows or more, they're down in that kind of 105, 107 range. I think that it's very easy for the euro here to have one more leg down. And so maybe the US dollar bull trend is not yet over with a euro potentially still vulnerable to the downside. But when we go to page 4, where we're looking at that US dollar yen, this US dollar just has not quit against that Japanese yen, just ripping higher and just day after day grinding up. This is certainly where we are seeing U.S. dollar bull leadership on a relative basis, and it'll be really easy if the pound and euro roll over here for the U.S. dollar to have one more leg.
Let's move on to gold futures on page 5.
You know, Eric, you were referencing just how you expect more out of gold. And while I certainly understand your point, and I wouldn't even want to push back on it, but if you just looked at this chart and didn't even take into consideration what it was and simply looked at it for what it is that there was a very long and extended consolidation for over a year, a very bullish breakout to a fresh high, one-year high, and the pullback so far has been well defended and bought on dip and is holding above all its previous highs. And while you know you could kind of say that you wanted more out of gold in these market conditions, I can see that argument, but this is still setting up pretty bullishly. And if we can clear 2,000 on the upside, I think it's going to get a lot of attention, and that could drive a bull trend move. So I'm still keeping a pretty solid bull tilt on my gold positioning. The one thing I wanted to highlight, though, Eric, is on page 6, we have silver. And silver has been dogging it on a relative basis to gold. But after spending almost 6 months in an extended basing formation, we are now seeing that kind of sequence of higher highs and higher lows developing. And if gold remains positive, this could be the conditions from which silver goes back to its multi-year highs in that $29, $30 range. So I still think that there's an opportunity here in the precious metals.
Let's move on to crude oil on page 7.
I think this is a really important moment here, Eric. I mean, I know you were talking about it in the market wrap, and I certainly would like to kind of hear what you think of my view. But it was a given that we were from a very oversold condition that we were going to get a bounce. So when crude oil goes from 130 down to like 95 in a week, it was going to have a reaction in a bullish way on the upside. And the fib retracement zones all lie right here in this kind of 110 to 115 pocket. So the big question for me is what happens from this pivot? If crude oil has a date with 130 to 150 on the upside, the bulls really do need to punch this higher from this level right here, right now. Probably the most disappointing thing that could happen here for oil bulls is it stall out here. And then if it does, then we might just be consolidating back down to 100 and then just grinding it in this kind of like $95 to $110 range for months. I'm not making that forecast here, but just pointing out how significant it is for the bulls to follow through here if they intend on running it higher.
Well, Patrick, I think it's going to be entirely event-driven. This is now about geopolitics. The price of crude oil has already rallied a little bit too much for the inflationary backdrop and other non-geopolitical factors that we had in play. Add the Russia-Ukraine situation, and I think there's scope to go much higher from here, but it's because of that tension being in the system. If that tension comes out of the system because there is a speedy and complete and total resolution to the Russia-Ukraine, and it's quite a bit broader than just Russia-Ukraine. It really is the Russian tension with the West. If that somehow is just going to go away overnight, then we're already too high on oil prices. They got to come down. I don't think any of that is happening. I think that the tension that we're seeing is just the beginning of a new era, and I think that oil prices are headed much higher. But the trading is much harder now because you really have to be banking on a geopolitical view, which is inherently very difficult to anticipate or predict.
Well, when we go to page 8 and look at the gasoline futures, I just wanted to highlight that it really actually seems to be trading in line with the oil chart. And we're at the same critical level here around the 350 a gallon level. So I think overall your point is pretty bang on in the sense that it is going to be headline driven. But it is still a very critical level on these energy prices, and it'll be really interesting to see what they do at this technical level. Let's move on to copper. And what I wanted to simply highlight here is that while copper did try to break out that $5 level and pull back, overall, it's still being well accumulated and holding up and still setting up for a breakout. So certainly, while you know we look at these charts that are bullish on everything from uranium to gold, copper still looks just as solid. It would be really interesting to see whether or not we can see copper beaten the 480 level and start heading back to its highs. That would, in my mind, indicate that another leg of a bull trend may very well be underway.
Looking at uranium on page 10, it looks like we're almost at the cycle high.
Well, exactly. When we were talking last week about the nice setup here, uranium continues to behave very bullishly. Obviously, anytime any commodity or any security comes back to its previous highs, it's always technically a significant moment to watch what it does along that resistance point. And so we are approaching a previous high, and it's important to note that. But overall, uranium's been very well bulled and very well accumulated over the last month. And I think giving the bulls the benefit of the doubt that they're going to punch it to new highs is, still a very reasonable proposition here. So it'll be interesting to see whether that bull breakout occurs.
Well, I think this is a really interesting one because, what is it, something like 40% of all nuclear reactor fuel in the world comes out of Russia. So the source of enriched uranium for running reactors, a lot of it comes out of Russia. And sure, maybe we're going to see a resolution to the immediate Ukraine war tension, but do we really think we're going to normalize relations with Russia to the point where everybody's comfortable with the West continuing to buy most of its nuclear reactor fuel from Russia? I don't think so. And if Russia is not going to be the source, the price has to go higher from here. Let's move on to fixed income, Patrick. In the next several charts, we've got everything from the 2-year yield all the way up through the 30-year yield. What's happening here?
Yeah, I just really wanted to highlight, just when put a visual chart up on these yields that we talk about. And it's just amazing to see the punch higher that we're seeing in these yields. The 2-year yield is almost accelerating to the upside in the last month. Same with that 5-year. We're just almost getting into a parabolic phase. This is leading to some very ugly bond drops and a lot of stress coming in the bond markets. And I'm actually a little bit surprised that the equity markets are not being overly nervous about this. But definitely when you're looking at all of these yields, they're pressing higher, and the rate of the increase in these yields seems to be just accelerating the rate of change. It'll be really interesting to see whether we just have some sort of a bond event in the next couple of weeks. It just feels like there's a lot of stress here.
Well, Patrick, I've always said, don't worry about a stock market crash. It's the bond market crash that really tells you the economy is in trouble. So let's keep our fingers crossed that that doesn't happen. On that cheery note, we're going to leave it there for this week's show. This episode is brought to you by Abex Technologies, pioneering the design of smarter markets that better serve the needs of both market participants and society as a whole. And by Masterworks, the billion-dollar alternative investment platform that lets you invest in art by legends like Warhol and Picasso for a fraction of the cost. Patrick, tell them what's in this week's Research Roundup.
In this week's Research Roundup, you're going to find the transcript for today's interview, as well as a link to the chart book we just discussed in this post game, as well as a number of links to articles we found really interesting. So you'll find this and so much more in this week's Research Roundup. So that does it for this week's episode. We appreciate all the feedback and support we get from our listeners, and we're always looking for suggestions on how we can make the program even better. Now, for those of our listeners that write or blog about the markets and would like to share that content with our listeners, send us an email at researchroundup@macrovoices.com, and we will consider it for our weekly distributions. If you have not already, follow our main Twitter account @macrovoices for all the most recent updates and releases. You can also follow Eric on Twitter @EricSTownsend, that's Eric spelled with a K, and myself @PatrickSresna. On behalf of Eric Townsend and myself, thank you for listening, and we'll see you all next week.
That concludes this edition of Macro Voices. Be sure to tune in each week to hear feature interviews with the brightest minds in finance and macroeconomics. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com, the Internet's premier source of online education for traders. Please visit BigPictureTrading.com for more information. Please register your free account at MacroVoices.com. Once registered, you'll receive our free weekly Research Roundup email containing links to supporting documents from our featured guests and the very best free financial content our volunteer research team could find on the internet each week. You'll also gain access to our free listener discussion forums and research library. And the more registered users we have, the more we'll be able to recruit high-profile feature interview guests for future programs. So please register your free account today at macrovoices.com if you haven't already. You can subscribe to Macro Voices on iTunes to have Macro Voices automatically delivered to your mobile device each week free of charge. You can email questions for the program to mailbag@macrovoices.com, and we'll answer your questions on the air from time to time in our mailbag segment. Macro Voices is presented for informational and entertainment purposes only. The information presented on Macro Voices should not be construed as investment advice. Always consult a licensed investment professional before making investment decisions. The views and opinions expressed on Macro Voices are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of the show's hosts or sponsors. Macro Voices, its producers, sponsors, and hosts Eric Townsend and Patrick Ceresna shall not be liable for losses resulting from investment decisions based on information or viewpoints presented on Macro Voices. Macro Voices is made possible by sponsorship from BigPictureTrading.com and by funding from Fourth Turning Capital Management, LLC. For more information, visit MacroVoices.com.